Thank you very much. First of all, thank you very much for inviting me. This is a really great occasion for me to think over what I'm doing, because I would ask not to give a formal lecture, but much more a research lecture. And research lecture means that I am working in a certain area, and I want to share with you the where we are, what are the results of our research, and what are the doubts I have. And this is an important thing, that I am not a very theoretical guy. I'm much more an empirical researcher. I like very much the facts, the lives, the realities, and but I think that the theory is very important, because this is what we structure my my work and my thoughts. Just a bit about myself. So I am really as old as you already mentioned, so even older at that time, because I finished the university in 74, and my professor was Ivan Serigny at that time, probably you know his name, and it was really a very great input or effect on our career and our way of thinking. And he had to leave the country at that time in 74, because he wrote a book, The Road of the Intelligentsia to the Power. Can you imagine that this kind of the title in 75 was something which didn't like very much the politics. But I will come back to Serigny Ivan theory, because his work on the housing systems is very important. Basically, I will structure this talk and discussion with you in three parts. First part, I would like to deal about the so-called East European housing model, whether it existed, what is the most important characteristics of this model. It's a question that why is it interesting? It's just in the past, you know, it was more than 30 years or around 30 years ago, why we are working on this. One of the reasons is that I am very much interested in these welfare regime theories. So how I think about the housing is that housing is a part of the society, and somehow in the housing system there is a lot of conflicts, a lot of inequality, what the society has to manage somehow, or just neglect it. You know? And we know from, if you look around even in this part of the Europe, there are very different level of the social safety net, social care, social policy. But this is a very important issue, that how this housing system managed their inequalities, their poverty, their conflicts in the housing system. And if you see the literature, they neglect this question. Very few theory deals with these models or these systems. And unfortunately, in the recent years, especially Hungary, there are certain directions which goes a kind of totalitarian system, authoritarian system. I mean, in Hungary, one of the interpretation of the last 5 years development in the Hungarian political life is that we are moving step by step in an authoritarian system. And question is that what will be the similarities? Okay, I forget to turn it on. What is the similarities to this system? So in the second part, this is in the last years, this was always one of the most important issue for us, and interesting issue, that how these housing systems and societies are developing after the transition. And this is a very hot topic even today. And there is a big discussion among the scholars that whether we are converging in one direction, or there are more divergent trend in the system. My conclusion, which is, of course, if you study this kind of the things, I'm sure that you will find a lot of facts, processes which are going in a divergent way. And there are a lot of other things which are very similar. So it's to tell the truth, I don't know the right answer to this question, but I tend to think that till 2008, basically, there was a very, very similar trend can be identified in the post-socialist countries. In new member states, it's better, because in Russia and Ukraine and other countries, I would leave from the future. This is the third issue, the Greek financial crisis, okay? And the other thing that feel free to interrupt me, okay? And then have questions, okay? It's really, if I say something which is not understandable or not even good. And the third question is that what happened after the financial crisis? So whether it has an effect on the societies, and how, what we learn from this, and of course most of the knowledge I am always working on the region, but of course most of the knowledge I have is from Hungary, so I am always accused that I am basically doing nothing, just generalizing my Hungarian experiences, which is true, of course, in a sense, but I try to incorporate other things. Something about the motivation. So what I am very much interested, even from the 70s, the how a society works, how the power is allocated to different classes, what are the class structure of a society, what are the most important conflicts. So I am not really especially interested in housing in itself. Housing is just an area understanding the social life or the society. And in the same things that when I am dealing with these social theories, of course, I want to understand that how the social structure of a society affect the housing market, the housing career, the housing conflicts. So what was the if you see the literature, most of the literature dealing with the socialist model basically, if they were from the housing perspective, they didn't make two crucial differences between the socialist and sometimes the socialist and the capitalist or the modern societies. If you see, if you see the tenure structure means that what is the ownership? There is basically three tenures in the housing research that we differentiate among three basic tenures: owner-occupied, private rental, and public rental. And if you see that the countries like even Czech Republic or Czechoslovakia at that time, Hungary and even Bulgaria, it was not very different from the Western countries. very much the Western countries. And there was some studies which didn't understand exactly that this very similar tenure structure, even the institutions were similar, cooperatives. We have cooperatives, you have cooperatives here. You have banks which offered bank loan for the cooperatives and even private persons. And we have local governments or councils at that time. So it was almost very, very looked very similar. But in reality, there was a very basic difference between these systems and other systems, that the basic regulatory mechanism in these societies before the transition was controlled by the state, institutions. Okay, this is the basic thing. So one of the most important research in this area was Ivan Serini's work in the end of the 60s and in the early 70s, when he was he did a very simple thing. He just studied that who gets housing, who has advantage when the state allocating housing units. And his conclusion was that the intelligentsia had 3 times higher chance to get access to the housing than the average people. Because it's, you see that composition of the social composition of the household in the cities, you know, there was 11% of the share of the intelligentsia. You know, this was a special term used for the people who had higher education and they basically have jobs related to this higher education. And in the new housing estates, they have 34% share. And this was, for us, if you see these things, it's not very, we wouldn't be very surprised or we wouldn't very much stuck by this fact. But at that time, it was a very important issue. So his work was based on the empirical study, and this conclusion was, and from this conclusion, he made a kind of theory arguing that the role of the state in the socialist countries is making the differences, making the inequalities, which was a very interesting idea, and in his politics was so-called ideology critics. It meant that, okay, I am not questioning the Communist Party ideology for the society or you about the society, but I want to contrast this ideology to the fact. And it was, his work was basically based on this approach. Even just a footnote that I am I did a proposal for Open Society Institute in these days for a small work study doing the same, because the Hungarian government has a lot of documents, and I want to reconstruct from this document how they think about the society, and just to see the fact that how these ideas are in the reality. And in principle, this proposal, and I hope so that it, next year it will be supported. And the other, I mean, the other, again a footnote, other reason for this is, I don't know what is the situation in Czech Republic, but I'm sure that what I know is very similar, that the NGOs and different think tanks who are working on housing in Hungary, they have very different views and have emphasis. And when they have a political step in the public, they are very weak, because they are, each has his own agenda, each has an own view, each has an own idea, and no cooperation. And my idea is that on the basis of this approach, we should define 4 C main topic, and each of the agencies and each of the NGOs has agreed on, and probably it will be a much more important more efficient thing. Okay, let's just it makes sense to just recall that in the welfare regime theory, literature. There were two scholars who incorporated the socialist countries in the models. There was the Wikensky and Titmus. These were the two scholars who were thinking that the socialist countries is can be managed or can be understood in the same way as the other welfare societies. Okay, just go back to the Ivan Senini theory. It was not very welcomed by the Western sociology, because his argument was that the state are doing something wrong. And at that time, the most of the urban sociology was very much left thinking, and they was arguing that fighting more state intervention and less market. And Ivan Senini said that in the socialist countries we have to improve or increase the market, because the market doing more equality than the state are doing. It's a strange idea. Ivan Senini sometimes has these strange ideas, and of course it was true. But as I in the previous slide I already indicated that in the housing law in 71 already included certain critics, or were reacting certain critics of Ivan Senini, and they were introducing a quite interesting allocation system, which tried to take into account the income of the household and the social status, social position of the household. It didn't work in this way, but there was a paper, there was a law at that time. And Ivan works, and of course, in the 70s, the housing system changed. If you see the number of the unit built, it was really increased in the 70s. It was a golden age in a sense, and you can see that at that time certain parts of the housing stock were allocated to the needy people, we started to work with Ivan Tošić at the 80s. And basically, all conclusion was that both the state and the market are causing the inequalities. And at that time we were very lucky to do empirical research, and we did a vacancy chain study, which was a very interesting method analyzing the filtration process in the housing market. Filtration means that we were studying that what happens with the housing unit, which is vacated by the household who moved to a new housing. And in the labor economics, this is a well-known research method. And we, at that time, as a young sociologist, enjoyed very much. You cannot do it, this kind of the study again in this time. You know, the response rate is much lower today. At that time, in the socialist period, it was much easier to do a survey. And I remember that the longest chain was 7. You mean that it was 7 units were vacated and used. And through this method, you could see that how the state intervention or the market intervention in the housing system affect the inequality, affect the social processes. So this was a conclusion was that if you want a more just society or just system in the housing, you have to change the market processes and you have to change the state processes. There is a quote, I don't want to repeat it, and Ivan Senini was nicely criticizing that, okay guys, it's not so simple, because state cannot intervene in itself. So it was a critic of at that time. I don't want to go to the details. But this was the how we thought at that time about the socialist system. This is a model which has two dimensions. One is that whether the market is controlled by the sector is controlled by the market processes or non-market processes, or it was a state or a private sector. The original Eastern European model was when basically the non-market state-owned sector dominated the system, and there was a small private sector. Non-market, it meant at that time that in the private sector there was a lot of self-help, self-construction. And then probably you are young, but your parents and maybe grandparents were building housing by themselves, a lot of cases. So there, and this was not really always market oriented. Of course, there was some kind of the transaction, but not very much market. And the Hungarian system moved when this market, private sector, or part in developed. And the West European model is when it is dominated by this market, private sector. But even the Western countries, there were small non-market private, and of course there was a market. And state, market and the state means that the state institutions, the councils, were facing to the to the market situation in terms of accessing the loans, accessing work, and this kind of things. Sure. Equality is that the chance, there's two things. If you see the stock, the equality, more equal system is that there is no huge differences in housing consumption, or there is a minimum standard of housing which is basically provided even through the market or through the state for everybody.
And
It has to do if the people in the public sector are living in a very poor neighborhood, or which is not always the case, but even today this could be a case. So this is the stock approach, and the flow approach is that the chance to get to the housing is equally allocated according. Two things. One thing, the position of the household in the society, so the so-called performance element, or when you are allocating the state subsidy, you are not preferring the higher income group, or you are preferring the lower income group, meaning it is not a regressive allocation of the state subsidy. And the Hungarian social system was a problem. A kind of problem was there that it was a regressive allocation system, which was understandable in a sense because the income differences didn't express the difference of the political position of the current different states of the societies. This one? This one?
It's first graph on top.
Sitting.
7.1.
Oh, no. This is, I'm sorry. This is from a book, right? I'm from, I mean, this chart or is taken out from a book, a paper we published together with Ivan Tošić in 1996. Okay? So this is, I'm sorry, this is the figure, number of the figure, okay?
So, okay. If the bar goes down, basically it was
either state or privately provided housing that used non-market mechanisms of allocation? Or
yes, and even the building and the construction as well.
Okay.
The provision.
The provision. So the downward in the Western European non-market means there was a sort of a neighbor help sector. Was privately paid private prices, they provided it for market prices?
Yes, I mean, they face basically to a market when they have to have an access to the loan. It was basically a market loan subsidized by the state, but this is what a market loan.
But neighbor help would be sort of a non-market provision mechanism?
The neighbor?
If I build my house with my neighbor.
Yeah. Is it non-market?
Yes. That would be a non-market.
Yes, according my, but
okay.
Again, this is I am. If I would have done this thing again, I probably not using the same terms. But it was important because Ivan Selin's theory was criticized because of this. They say that you are not right when we are talking about market is making a more equal allocation. It is not really the market. It is because I am building with your help a housing, and this kind of the transaction is not very strictly market oriented, because my family, my friends are helping, and even in this help they are making a loan, or they give me their workforce as a kind of loan, but the interest rate is not marketly based. Okay, so this is okay. I want to just to jump we had at that time with Ivan Tošić, we were writing pieces about the so-called East European housing model. We called it, thinking about that what would be the ideal type of the socialist housing system, and I don't want to go into details, and our approach was that these societies couldn't follow the theory of the socialist housing model because they had to face the reality, the political and economic reality at that time. And how we conceptualized this, that there were some cracks, some conflicts in the system. So, for example, there was according to Engels, for example, if you see the literature, you have enough housing, it's just an allocation problem, how you allocate the housing units, housing stock among different strata. But the socialist countries were in a huge pressure under the urbanization and industrialization. And because of the industrialization, they have to move a lot of people to the urban area, and of course, this was against the economic strategy at that time, because the economic strategy was that you have to put most of the resources of the society in the industry and less on consumption and on housing. So this was a kind of the cracks in the system, and we tried to make some typology how the different societies manage this kind of the cracks. And so this is the structure how I recapture the socialist model, but I think it's better to start with the modern society and come back later. So right now there is a huge literature with working on the housing regime issue, and probably the Kameny theory of the housing regime typology, which is the Kemeny idea was that the most of this literature is very much focused on the tenure structure. So this is the most important. The homeownership has an effect on the society. If there is a more balanced tenure structure, you have social housing, you have private rental, and you have owner-occupied, this is a much more healthy for the society. Kemeny's basic argument was that if you have too much home ownership, it has a bad effect. I mean, I'm simplifying very much this. And he compared Australia, UK, England, and Sweden. And he was arguing that Australia has the most home ownership society, most conservative one. And the British has a between the equal allocation of the, more equal composition of the tenures, and Sweden is the best. And just a private thing, because my kids are living in Australia. I have been visited Australia several times, and I just couldn't agree with this idea. That for me, it was a very nice society in terms of the social inequality. Even the homeownership is very, very high. But anyway, so I was. I think Kemeny and the whole literature too much is occupied by this tenure approach. This is very much Anglo-Saxon approach of the housing regime. So what I think that this is one kind of the literature which is overlapping with the welfare regime theories. The welfare regime theories is very important because this is a question how these modern societies react to the social conflicts, and the question is that whether how the housing is managed by the societies, whether the housing inequalities are somehow managed by the welfare regime element. But in the original theory of the welfare regime, it was not they were not dealing with the housing. And one of the reasons was because housing is a very strange commodity. It's partly a consumption commodity and partly an investment commodity. And it's housing always has a lot of systematic connection to the market. So the housing literature suffered a lot about how they can combine the welfare regime theory and the housing theory. And there is another interesting and neglected thing, the economic structure. So what is the economic, and this literature is the varieties of capitalism type of the literature. That what are the most important element, institutions, and what, how you can characterize these institutions system, in the society, and these are somehow causally related to each other, and has an effect on the housing or output in terms of the housing tenure, shortage, affordability, homelessness issue, and so on. But of course, I don't know the answer. I mean, this is just a framework. How I, when I am studying any housing-related issue, I try to incorporate this kind of the elements of the analysis, and the same. And the same way, this is how I can make a theory, or how I can build up a theory of the socialist housing system. So there was a socialist housing development model, and it has different alternatives. and which has a housing outcome. A different alternative means this is a kind of combination of the economic and the welfare element of the system. And for example, Hungary and Yugoslavia at that time was very similar. And the reason it was Hungary very similar, it was very simple. In Hungary, the agriculture and the market processes in agriculture was very important. And what it meant that that households have a small plot, and they were producing a lot of production in this small plot, and they could sell on the market, okay? And it had a very important housing consequence, because if you stop and don't allow them to use their money, income, for housing, it doesn't work. So basically, there was a compromise from the housing policy that they let these people to build their own homes. It sounds stupid now. But at that time, how many bricks a society, an economy were producing a year was defined by the National Planning Institute. How much loan was issued in a year was defined by the National Planning Institute. So this is why in the socialist countries, we have a banks and we had a market for the materials, but basically there was a shortage of these things. And that was how Markus Feher and Heller book, Dictatorship Over the Need, is the category of the socialist system. Okay, so this is Okay, here we are. okay, so next question is, what happened after the transition? And this is just a story of what happened in Hungary, but I don't want to go in right now. There is one interesting thing, and this is, I mean, this chart is interesting, so maybe this was to talk a little bit more. It starts from 1980. Till now, okay? And there is two data. One is the house price data, and the other is the mortgage, the share of the mortgage to the GDP. And this is the the blue. No, this is the mortgage. I'm sorry, I have to check. Yes. This is the mortgage, maybe I did a mistake here, because this is the house price and this is the mortgage, I'm sorry, okay? This is the mortgage. The mortgage meaning that how much share is the outstanding mortgage housing loan to the GDP. And this is an indicator how you finance housing. If there is a very small mortgage, it means that the people and the society finance housing from cash and inheritance from the from the state budget revenues, and there is no loan in the system. Okay. So if you have a very high mortgage, it means that you have a much modern system. It's very important, if you think housing, that housing finance and the role of the mortgage is very, very important in a normal system. Because if there is no mortgage, it means that you have to depend very much on your parents and your relatives in terms of the first time buyer situation, and probably this is the case even today. But something interesting happened in Hungary between 1980 to 1990, which is how I would conceptualize is that very similar like in China. So Hungary, it was a crisis in the 80s. Basically, in the early 80s, the socialist countries realized that they are big trouble in competing with the United States and the Western countries in the arm race. You know, and it was very clear that it is a problem. So each of the countries in that time give more autonomy to play with. And Poland, we know that in that time is basically bankrupted and was a big problem. And Hungary in that time opened to the market. So Hungary wanted to move to the China's model, but we didn't have the resources and a lot of other things. And what we, my interpretation is that basically the loan were used basically for consumption at that time, and just managed the consumption and didn't contribute for the economic potential of the country, which is not the case in China and even not the case in other countries. So basically there was this is one very interesting thing. The other interesting thing, which is each country had a crisis in the 90s in the new member states, because in the transition this is a recession. And the recession ended, I will skip it, this one, but the recession ended in 2000, around 2000, and there was a very important period from 2000 to 2008. And these countries, what the countries were doing at that time, had a very important effect on this crisis management. Yes.
Because in the Czech Republic, I think that it was in the 90s when it was first time that the households could pay mortgage. So in Hungary, it was in 1984 or 1982.
Yes, in Hungary, from the 1980, their move toward a more market-oriented system, as the same way as Yugoslavia.
I don't know what was the inflation rate in Hungary, but in the beginning of transformation in Czechoslovakia, the inflation was rather high. So that's why maybe the real house prices decreased quite significantly in your chart, and maybe why the ratio of the housing loan to GDP decreased significantly low too, because I don't know how the mortgages were set at that time. If they were set at a fixed interest rate, it means that after 2 years of inflation with 100%, you decrease all indicators to 1 quarter.
You are right, absolutely right. One clarification that in the 80s in Hungary, and I don't know whether it was true in Czechoslovakia at that time or not, the housing as an investment good became very important for the household. So they basically invest in housing. There was a bubble. They invest in housing, and the housing price increased at that time from 1980 to 1990. And this increase was partly supported by the subsidy system and the housing finance system. The subsidy system, because household at that time got subsidy for the own construction, the family housing construction, they get the subsidy. And this subsidy system increased. Okay, I want to just emphasize two things from this chart. One thing that the socialist countries tried to modernize their economy. It didn't work in Hungary. And this is a very important period. So this is the way how I try to conceptualize the most important conflicts of the transition. So basically, the countries had a fiscal stress, and there was a This was the reason of the transition. We couldn't manage the economy without without structural changes. So you have to introduce some kind of the structural changes, which was privatization and decentralization. These were the basic two things in different parts of the economy, and different speed and different way and a different method. It was very different in the countries. But there was three things which influenced this. There was the public policy, how the politicians and the political elite was thinking about the changes. And there was emerging new private interest. It was very important, new banks, new companies, new elite. And there was international agency. And in the literature, it's very interesting that a lot of scholars who are dealing with the welfare system in the Eastern European countries argue that basically the World Bank, the IMF, forced this country to privatize, to introduce measures which was not really justified by the society. My conclusion is that this is overemphasized. I mean, the literature. Is it, and most of the cases, countries didn't do something that they didn't want to do, even in the IMF and the World Bank request. Of course, there was a kind of the pressure, but it depends very much on the public, the new elite, political elite, and the private interest. I was from 1996 till 2010, I was a member of the Housing Policy Committee in Hungary, and this was a committee doing basically nothing. So it was really no any significance of this committee. But you were sitting with important guys, you know, and you heard a lot of things. From the sociological point of view, it was very interesting. And I know that how these people were thinking, and how the private the bank interest were influencing the situation. So the point is that somehow there are structural changes, and these changes has social cost. And the question is, and the question was that how these costs were allocated among the different parts of the society. And recently I was in a conference, and I have it was an interesting observation that the intelligentsia, the elite, at that time in the 90s, were very strong transferring the cost of the transition to the low class, the working class, and these people. So if there was any proposal to change the taxation system, which punished the highly educated people, they were so efficient to block this taxation. So the one of the point is that this is the most important conflict of the transition, that how the social costs are allocated. And one of the most interesting and important research question for me, the coping strategy, how the people cope with this, informal economy, the family and network economy, and there was a new element of the social welfare policy which start gradually introduced. But the problem was that, and this is one of the most important issue even today, that their efficiency is very questionable in this day. So what happened in the most of the countries is that there were basically three types of the forces making market, correcting the market, and coming back to the old routine. I don't want to go on this thing, but my conclusion was that if you just to see the privatization, which was a very general trend in privatization of the housing privatization here, I mean, it was a very general trend, and there is a lot of papers about the privatization. People love this issue somehow. My conclusion is that, and today I don't know whether you have the same kind of the discussion, that it was a mistake to privatize. This is the basic reason. And this is something which is very strange for me. At that time, politically, there was no other options. And each country privatized. The only country, I mean, this is Czech Republic, was the less on this way. And then there was another very interesting difference between among the new member states in terms of the restitution. So this is privatization, one thing. The housing output followed a very similar way. It was a decline, and somehow in the 2000 we went back to the 90s level, which was already small. Each country started the new housing finance system. In each country, the mortgage market started to emerge. And some of the countries introduced the foreign exchange mortgage scheme. So basically, these are the reason I my conclusion is that till 2008 there was no big difference. Of course, there was some differences in terms of the institutional structure. The Polish, for example, never allowed the Bausparkasse system in Poland. You know the Bausparkasse, we have the Bausparkasse system in Czech Republic. It's a very, there was very, very, very aggressive banks, by the way. So they really very efficient and very aggressive banks. In Hungary, even today, they are the most important subsidy target is the Bausparkasse model. So, so what happens after the crisis? That one other thing is that again, if we raise the same question that Ivan Senin asked, that how the state and the public housing policy influence the housing inequalities, and there are three types of the interventions which influence the housing inequalities. The one type increased the inequalities. The housing privatization in every country increased the inequalities. Why? Because if you had a more valuable housing unit, because of the privatization scheme, your gain after the privatization was much more than if you have a small unit. Okay, so this was a very regressive way of the allocating money. It was very interesting that when this privatization law in Hungary was introduced, we already knew from the British case that this is a very contradictory process. And we were criticizing the way how they privatize. Is it clear that how you can make money? If you had a unit which has a 100,000, let's say, euro today, where you know, and you pay 10%, okay? This was the average, 10-15% of the market price you had to pay for the privatized unit. Or your gain is 90,000, okay? If you have a 20,000 unit which has a market value of 20,000, and you pay 10%, it is your gain is 18,000, right? Against the 90,000, okay? So the question was that if the housing units were allocated before the transition inequally, the privatization scheme increased the inequality of the society very much. Okay, very interesting that the World Bank study in Russia was arguing that it is not true in Russia, because in Russia the housing units were allocated more equally. Yes.
So these people, they would still live under regulated rents, right? Before privatization.
Before privatization, it was a small rent. Yes.
So there was this inequality because some people lived in regulated rents in big apartments, some people in small apartments. So I don't think it's correct to say that that privatization increased inequality; it just petrified it. So that because it was there, even before.
I mean, the privatization realized, through the privatization, you realized this inequality in monetary sense, right? So maybe because if you rent...
People are some are consuming very, very big apartment in the center of Budapest, right, for very, very
low rent.
Whereas somebody else would pay the same amount of money for much
for the outside...
So this is still an inequality in consumption, right? And then if you privatize it, you just sort of...
Okay, but you don't know whether I am going to increase your rent in the downtown area or not. This was the point. That at that point, you are right, but there was a new system was introduced, and the question was whether are we going to increase the rent in the downtown area and charge a more acceptable rent for them, or... they can realize the market differences of these units, okay? I mean, this, if you calculate that how much money we are talking about is a huge money. So there was a huge allocation of the public asset among the social classes. And the political elite happily supported this. You know, there was no real question. In our company at that time, yes?
Exactly.
Okay, so this was one, and then there was another, these old loan mortgages. You remember that we have a big mortgage, and they did the same with the mortgages. I mean, because basically the banking system bankrupted in 1990, because we had a long-term fixed-rate mortgages, and we have a 18-20% inflation. Okay, so this was and there was another interesting models, which is very dangerous one. Very dangerous one, and even today very dangerous. That you offer something which in a short run make a better position for some poor people. For example, the Roma program. No, it wasn't Roma program. We called, it was a very interesting case in Hungary that in 1994 we introduced a housing construction grant for the household who have a big grant for the household who have three or more children. Okay? And of course, the Roma people have higher probability to see or more children. What was very interesting that I know the story how this measure were designed by the politicians. And the guy who was the head of the department of the housing department told me that he was swimming in the morning and he was thinking that what kind of the subsidy he can introduce. And he concluded, because in Hungary, the 5% of the household have more than three children, and it's a nice idea to introduce this big subsidy for them, because it politically it will be very popular, because the kids, we are supporting the kids, and probably very few people will take this subsidy. But what happened, that a business was organized on this, entrepreneurs were looking for Roma families and manage everything. So basically, a Roma family without any money got a new house. But this new house was a terribly poor house, mostly outside of the cities. So basically, it was a kind of sending them in a remote places through public money. But in short run, it was allocated according to need, because there really was very poor people. And there is a and I think this is a big issue here today in Hungary. And I don't know what is in Czech Republic, the politics in Czech Republic. But we have a stupid idea, I mean, not stupid idea, I wouldn't say stupid idea, that one of the ideas is that if there is an underdeveloped area in the country, we have to develop this area to equalize somehow the life chance in remote places in the country, like in the more developed parts of the country. But we are doing studies, and the only conclusion is that this area just not competitive with other area. Okay, so this eastern part of the Hungary is just not competitive with the western parts of the country. Doesn't matter that you are putting a lot of money in there, and most of this money is for training of Roma people for something which you never will use, okay, or poor people. So, and it has something with the housing, because most of the people, because of the if you remember this social cost of the transition, the people who owned or rented good houses in the cities, they were forced out of the cities because of the pressure of the affordability issue, and they moved for a much cheaper area of the country, and they are lost there. So in Budapest, for example, today, if in today price, is a 50 million forint is a house in the housing estates outskirts of the city. And the people cannot pay this money. They can move in a city, in a village, for 2 million forint. Okay? So they can cash 30 million forint. Of course, in typical cases, they already have a debt, 5 million forint here. Okay? So basically, they cash 8 million forint, which they spend 1 year or 2 years. Okay? And they are living in a very poor home outside of the a city in a where they have no employment possibility, no good rich. Okay. I have to economize with my time. I have okay. We have a new research project about the mortgage program in Hungary. The mortgage program is because it is in the last 5 years, this was the most important issue in the Hungarian story. And of course, the problem was that from 2004 to 2008, most of the people take a loan in foreign exchange loan. They took a foreign exchange loan, and it caused a lot of problems. In the last 5 years, the government are rescuing the people in this situation. And there is a blame game. That who is responsible for this game? And this is very interesting in a sociological and political view. And of course, the banks.
May I ask, what do you mean by FX loan?
This is, you don't have this here in Czech Republic.
I know.
This, it was a vice. When you, to take a loan in Swiss franc, okay? The reason why you take a loan in Swiss franc, if the Czech loan has a 10% interest rate, and you are offered a 2% interest rate in Swiss loan, you say that why not? It's a nice deal, okay? But you are taking the exchange rate risk, And this is the problem, okay? In Czech Republic, it was not so, first, it was not legally, I think, possible, and there was not so big differences, okay? Because the housing loan was quite affordable in Czech Republic. Okay. I already used my time. I didn't want to go into details of this, but it was the point is that Hungary government subsidized the mortgage in the first 4 years. Okay, a huge subsidy, and politically and economically unacceptable huge subsidy. They say that we are paying the 70% of the interest rate, what you have to pay, and we give you a tax exemption, and we are supporting even the banks for if they're issuing the long-term mortgages. The points, it was a huge, and they cut the subsidy in 2004, they cut the subsidy, and the banks introduced the foreign exchange loan, and it was very successful, okay? And the good banker at that time, this is why the blame game is a golden mine for the sociologists and political science people, because at that time, a good financial expert said that, okay, guys, it's a risky thing, you know, because the exchange rate risk is your problem. If the Swiss franc is appreciated, you will have to pay more. But according to my calculation, in the last 20 years, the maximum change of the Swiss franc was 5-10%, okay? So you have a risk, but it's manageable, right? But in 2008, this was 60%. Not 10%, okay? And it was not manageable risk. And of course, whom we can blame? The government, the national bank, the banks itself, the household, or this is the and just I want to. To close the presentation by, we have a very strange government, unfortunately, I mean in Hungary, and which is we call unorthodox economic policy, which tried that no austerity, and that this is, I mean, it's not exceptional, because this is, something strange is happening in Europe. The Greece, Portugal, Poland, Hungary are playing with these ideas, and others are playing with ideas that we don't need austerity. If the economy is in a trouble, we don't need austerity, because there are other solution for this. In Hungary, the other solution was that you are using reserves of the society, reserves in terms of the private pension fund, for example, and state utility companies. They just stop the investment in there. They taxing the foreign companies and centralized. They introduced a lot of centralization and renationalization, and of course the EU fund. And this is my interpretation. Maybe I'm not right. My interpretation is that the government is postponing the structural changes with this kind of the resources. But it's a politically sensitive question, so maybe I'm not right, because I am biased politically. This could be a problem, and it is. And of course, there's a redistribution, and somehow the middle class and upper middle class was preferred with this. And I give you just and this is how you change the income distribution, okay? So basically the lowest 10% suffer most. And just I want to show you that this is the story about this mortgage rescue program, different elements, which is I am happy to share with you the details. But what I want to show this new table is a household survey we are doing right now, and we are in the middle of the analysis. And we defined five classes, basically according to employment status and education. And you can see that the lower 20%, right? This is the share of the group is around 20%, is in a deep, very, very deep trouble. In terms of the one-third of this social class household, the one-third of households are living substandard homes, very poor homes, overcrowded homes. 50% have arrears, cannot pay the housing cost. And of course, they are living in rural settlements outside of the city. And I think that this is a very important social problem. But somehow, the government and the politics is very successful to not hide, because you cannot hide exactly, but not to allow this issue to be in the political agenda. Okay, so we have always other things, and today the best and most important is the migration. You know that the politics just play with the migration to hiding, I think, a lot of very important social issues. And this is the conclusion of the rescue program, basically, that is which I would be happy to go into details if there is any interest. But the point is that it is not solved yet. Not solved yet. 28% of the people who have loans is a non-performance loans, the loans which people are not paying back. So there's a huge, 250,000 households in the society, we have the same size as Czech Republic, it's a huge amount who have a problem of paying the loans. And it would be a huge problem. Well, I would stop here. And I'm sure that you have questions. And just one conclusion, that there is a lot of elements of these talks. Even I am not absolutely sure. It's just a hypothesis. And of course, when you are doing research, it's easy to talk to you, okay? And hope that this is not going to anywhere of this thing in terms of the... Because you can it's more a research talk, right? And if I have to write something, I am more strict and following the rules of the game, and this is more a kind of free thoughts about these societies.
Okay. Thank you, Roger, for your stories.